Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on Wednesday morning. I want to start with a quote by Albert Einstein. I'm into Albert Einstein. I've been quoting him a lot these days. Look on my Facebook page. But this one is so pithy, but so appropriate. A foolish faith in authority is the worst enemy of truth. Let me repeat that. Albert, you were so smart. A foolish faith in authority is the worst enemy of truth. It made me think of something, Stephanie. I don't know if I ever told you this, and then we'll get into our first guest. And that is that when I was running for office, I said that all political candidates should offer two statements at the beginning of their campaigns. The first one was a financial statement, and the second one was their failure statement, that they should reflect and make public what they believe are their failures. Like, for example, I was pregnant when I got married. Well, you know, my mother thought that was a failure, you know? I will be honest with you, I plagiarized a paper in college. I almost killed myself. I almost was suicidal. And it taught me to trust my voice. It was a horrific situation, but it taught me to trust my voice. And I think in some ways that's part of the problem is that we have this faith in authority and we elevate money, which is, explains Donald Trump. What we fail to do is recognize that not only is he a liar, I think he lied 21 times a day during the course of his time as president, but that he's a cheater and he has failed on so many occasions, but he knows how to paper it over with his money. So again, I want to read Albert Einstein's quote, "A foolish faith in authority is the worst enemy of truth." So joining us right now is Elliot Haspel. We have had Elliot on a number of times. We are so grateful that he exists. He's a nationally recognized child and family policy expert and commentator. He has a specialty in early childhood and education policies. He's the author of Crawling Behind America's Childcare Crisis and How to Fix It, and a senior fellow at the think tank Capita. Elliot has appeared on television as an analyst. And of course, you didn't include me in your list of places where you've appeared, Elliot, but I will forgive you for this. But you sent me a piece that was embargoed and just released, I believe, yesterday. And I will tell you, it is a novelette, but it is so important. And the title of the piece is "The End User is a Dollar Sign. It's Not a Child. How Private Equity and Shareholders Are Reshaping American Childcare." And I just want everyone to know this is a really important piece. I'm going to post it up on Facebook. I will share it. I recommend that you read it, that you share it with legislators, that you share it with your members of Congress, because this is really a truly crucial, crucial issue. If you think Dobbs is a problem, childcare coupled with Dobbs makes life for families and women almost impossible to imagine going into the future unless you are incredibly wealthy. And Elliot, as I was looking at your piece, I was also getting ready for my Friday show. And so I am looking and I go to The Hill all the time. And interestingly enough, Mr. Haspel, as your piece is landing, these two stories come out literally within 48 hours of your piece at The Hill, which is like this political, you know, it covers everything about what's happening in Congress and Washington, and it's very Washington focused. And the first one is, California is rolling out free preschool. Ah, but that hasn't solved challenges around childcare. There you go. Piece one. Piece two, America's childcare crisis is holding back moms without college degrees. That too is at The Hill. And then I thought, yeah, I'm just going to sort of Google childcare at The Hill. And I found a story from late February. Here's where childcare is the most expensive. And I looked at the map and I went, of course. So let me welcome you to the program. Thank you so much for writing this piece. We've been covering a lot about what happens when private equity takes over things, whether it's taking over emergency rooms, whether it's taking over nursing homes, whether it's taking over hospice. And the results are not pretty, okay? And consistently, it is not an asset. It turns out to be a liability. And then, of course, what is your story about? How private equity and shareholders are reshaping American childcare. I want to welcome you to the program, but will you give me the opportunity to read the opening editor's note? Because it was the mea culpa, as if trying to explain what they are about to read, that in some ways, I will be honest with you, it kind of offended me. Because everything you did was credible. Everything you did was fact-based. Everything you did was vetted by the publication. You also came to a conclusion. So 2 + 2 = 4. That's a fact. Is that my opinion? You know, I'm like, I don't think so. And after reading your piece, I was like so outraged, because you'd have to be dull not to see what the conclusion was based on the numbers and the facts and the interviews you did, all of which were so rich, but all of them pointed in one direction, which was not necessarily positive. And what she writes, the editor writes, is Elliot is a well-known child care policy expert and author, as well as a freelance journalist. For this story, he employed investigative journalism techniques to provide a deep look into the workings and implications of growing investor and private equity. I don't know what else you could have done except investigative journalism, but needless to say, it should be noted up front that Elliot has an established perspective about private equity in childcare, which leans towards skepticism, and he has also conducted research and analysis on the subject. As such, this article should be considered reported opinion, which former ProPublica editor-in-chief Paul Steiger once defined as where fact-gathering takes place in service of advocacy. That said, this piece has been thoroughly vetted by an experienced independent fact-checker. As usual, this piece and all opinions therein are Elliot's alone. And I'm just going to tell you, Elliot, I understand why she had to, why she had to say that. But again, as I read it, I will be honest with you. If I ever ran a campaign, and my audience has heard me say this a million times, my entire campaign would be on three words: do the math. All right? Because I want people to trust what they are hearing. Not because I like Arnie, or because I'm an authoritarian figure, or because I'm a lefty or a liberal, or because I want them to see the numbers, and I want them to see what those numbers mean for their families, for their state, for the results of the future. And those numbers are numbers, as you know, I would also have them vetted. But I want to just tell you, thank you for doing this.
Sure.
I'm glad they allowed you to put this into this publication, but I want to make sure that it just doesn't stay in this publication, that as many people read it as possible, because I am terrified by what I read.
Well, I really appreciate that. And, you know, I should say, like, all praise and credit to my editor over there at Early Learning Nation, Linda, who took on, and it is, you know,
it's extensive.
It takes a measure of courage to tackle, you know, big moneyed interests. And I think part of it too is why we wanted to say that up front is, you're right, 2 + 2 = 4. What we know are the tactics of many sort of large corporations when there is something they don't like that comes out is to try to discredit whoever wrote it. And what we didn't want them to do is come back at the back end and be like, oh, look, here's this guy who wrote this big piece, but actually he's, you know, he's pretending he's objective and he's actually written, you know, X, Y, and Z in the past. So it was to hopefully just get up front.
Let's remember what the cigarette industry used to do. Let's remember what oil, coal, and gas did. They know about climate change. They knew about it for 30 years, maybe 40 years. Yeah. I mean, I just want people to remember, this is not something where the result is not accurate. This is something about wanting to distort the result because they have the money to flood the zone. And therefore they flood the zone with distortion as opposed to the facts. And I am grateful to this publication because not only do they allow you to do this, they vetted it. They told everyone they did.
Yes.
And now we can trust at least what we are reading as you come to your conclusion. Start though with the story of Yale. Because first, my show airs in Connecticut, airs actually on the campus of Connecticut Wesleyan, but it goes into places as far as Yale. And I want people to hear this story because this is an enlightened institution. This is something that wants to support their staff, support their faculty. And to read this at the beginning was so depressing because it's the story of Yale New Haven Hospital System that announced a change in their two childcare centers. And you would just sort of hope that, you know, with the institutional support of Yale, that they would be making decisions that would not just look at, we're exhausted by, you know, having to run this, but make decisions that would also both benefit their employees as well as their employees' children.
Yeah, so the Yale New Haven Hospital System runs two childcare centers in New Haven that are for both employees of the hospital system. They're also available to community members. And in January, they suddenly, without a lot of warning, announced this change that instead of running those centers themselves, they were going to be basically turning over operations to a company called Bright Horizons. Bright Horizons is one of the largest corporate chains in the country. It is the only one that is traded on the stock market. It used to be owned by a private equity firm, Bain, which we're all familiar with from Mitt Romney's campaign. And so what they the reason they did this, they said in a call with parents, was to basically as a cost-cutting measure. And that raises the question, how do you cut costs by turning over a program to a company like Bright Horizons? And well, what Bright Horizons has started to do is they made all of the educators at those centers reapply for their jobs, regardless of how long they'd been there. And in the process of doing so, it stripped them of their benefits while they were reapplying for their jobs. They also are raising class sizes, essentially. They're making it so there'll be more students per teacher. And then they're also pressing into service, because in childcare, you have to have legally mandated ratios of children to adults. So they're pressing into service the administrative, so secretary, the center director, right? They're making these non-teaching roles act as teachers so they can stay in ratio. And as a result of all of this, a lot of teachers, unsurprisingly, have left. And so now those centers are actually at risk of everything from not being able to serve as many children to being able to closing altogether because they're not able to make those ratios. And it's just such a, I think, a kind of canonical example of, okay, here comes this big corporate for-profit childcare chain that has investors behind them. They're making money. How?
I guess my first question is, as I was reading this, I was so upset, but not surprised. Okay. I've seen this story happen over and over again. Did anyone ask, or was the contract that Yale, the Yale hospital system made with New Horizons, was that made public? Could anyone
Bright
see
Horizons?
It? Anyone, I mean, with New Horizons, I mean, I'm just kind of curious because I'm just trying to figure out what were they willing to compromise in order to turn over these two childcare centers? Were they aware of the compromise before they entered into the contract? I mean, again, they do have an obligation to their employees, and it appears that, you know, they said, okay, we're going to maintain childcare, but there's childcare and then there's New Horizons or Bright Horizons childcare. And it turns out that they may not be the same animal.
Yeah, so we don't have a copy of that contract. A lot of this information is coming. I mean, this was all reported by the Yale Daily News. It's coming from parents who and educators who attended meetings with the hospital staff and with Bright Horizons leadership. So that's where we're getting this from. But I will tell you, this is a trend. I didn't get into this in the piece, but a lot of universities, a lot of hospital systems who used to run their own programs are increasingly turning them over to these investor-backed chains like Bright Horizons and KinderCare, who basically say, we'll take this off your plate and so you don't have to worry about it, because childcare is not a fun thing to run. It's expensive. Again, we don't treat it like a public good in this country. And there are, I think, compromises being made as a result of that. And, you know, these companies are set up to do it, right? Bright Horizons and KinderCare have entire departments that are dedicated towards this, working with institutional clients like corporations and universities. And, you know, I cite in there, Maricopa County in Arizona entered a $13 million contract with KinderCare to run a center for county employees. So it's a very lucrative line of business for these companies.
You go through your piece and you sort of break it down into sections. The first one is profit from an unprofitable industry. And that's the thing that actually blows my mind. Well, the last place I would want to be in would be childcare. When I discovered, or I was looking at the story at The Hill, because I mentioned there were three stories about childcare at The Hill, and they were talking about the state that's the most expensive state was Massachusetts, by the way, mm-hmm. and the average cost in Massachusetts for childcare for a year was $20,000. Process that, everyone, $20,000. So think about what you would have to earn. I mean, after paying for your rent or your mortgage or your food or, you know, your car payment, and then spend another $20,000 for childcare. That's like almost unfathomable. And yet that's the problem. So I guess the question is, what induced them to even think that they could somehow squeeze a profit out of this kind of bare bones concept called childcare? I mean, they can look around. I mean, it's not like healthcare where you got Medicare and Medicaid and insurance. This is childcare. Nobody covers it but a struggling parent for the most part.
Yeah. So, you know, private equity is very, very good at finding any sort of market opportunity. And what they found is that in childcare, there's a couple of characteristics that they do like. One is that there is enormous demand, right? The demand is never ending, right? There's always sort of inelastic, meaning like it's not going to change. There is going to constantly be demand. And number two, in some ways, you have a captive customer base. What I mean by that is, and you know, in you really, if you don't like your child's childcare program or you think they're charging you too much, there's not a lot you can do about it, because good luck finding another slot, right? In our supply constrained market, because there's no public money, there isn't a lot of supply X, Y, and Z. And so there are these characteristics. And then the other thing they do is these firms and companies tend to go after the profitable part of the market. And what I mean by that is, yes, it is almost impossible for most lower working middle class families to think about paying $20,000 a year
Right.
for childcare. It's not impossible, though, for families living on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, right? Living in the Tony
Yes.
parts of Boston. Like, it is actually possible. And so if you go after that part of the clientele, you can actually make enough money from them. And so that's what we see, is we see a lot of these programs are really offering kind of premium services. They're playing off of parents' stress and anxiety about giving their kids, a leg up from the beginning of life. And so they are able to serve. And then the other thing they're doing, in addition to pushing these programs, so right, private equity comes in, takes over a company. So management is putting pressure on the frontline workers. So this story is not about the directors and the educators in these programs. They are trying their damnedest to do right by kids, but they're getting all of this pressure, my sort of investigation revealed, from corporate to keep enrollment up no matter what. Keep those classrooms open. Doesn't matter if the teachers feel well qualified enough, in some cases. Doesn't matter what's kind of going on. Like, oh, in almost every case, you've got to keep those classrooms open. You've got to keep those paying customers in the door. And then you also have to lower operational costs, right? So what I reported on a few examples, former teachers and directors saying things like, we were told to give kids one sheet of paper a day, right? We were told to only give them the amount of food every day that was federally reimbursable. So the federal program that will pay childcare programs per, kind of like school lunches, but there's only a certain number of meals or snacks that they'll reimburse. And so they're basically, it doesn't matter if a kid's hungry, like, don't give them more money, because that's going to cost us money. That's not getting reimbursed, right? It's coming out of our bottom line. When you don't buy new toys, go out and find, if you want toys for the kids, you got to go find them, like, used, or find them from like a thrift store somewhere, right? You need to clean the classroom yourself. These sorts of minimized operational costs, combining with really strong pushes to keep enrollment of affluent parents mostly very high, and you start to see, okay, you can actually squeeze blood out of the stone. It's going to hurt, but you're going to be able to squeeze a profit.
So let me just stop you. So there's a couple of things I'm thinking about. So they're cherry picking. They only want the affluent customer, which is really what they refer to the parents, not the parents' customer, I'm sure. Anyway, but if I'm an affluent parent, I don't want used toys in my classroom. I don't want one piece of paper. If I'm paying $15,000, $20,000, and I am affluent and I live in the Tony part of New York City, I suspect that when I walk into that classroom, I want to know the quality of the teacher. I want to know what the teacher-student ratio is, and I want to know how rich the environment is going to be for my little tutty. So part of me thinks that, are parents asleep at the switch and don't give a crap, number one. Number two, I mean, do they hide what they do? I mean, it's kind of hard to hide what you do. And again, one of the things I was reading about is that what's so frustrating here is that we're not even sure what the consequences are. So we haven't had enough people within the system that have done the analysis of what happens when a child is in a well-funded childcare versus an underfunded childcare versus whatever. But I would think that if you're trying to appeal to the cream of the crop, you can't give them crap. And yet what I'm hearing from you is that they're trying to thread the needle, make a profit, do as little as possible, and still somehow market themselves to the people that can afford the $20,000 a year.
Well, I mean, you just said the magic words is market, right? And so this is,
Okay.
as you mentioned, a very long piece, and we didn't
It's
get into
incredibly
every
long.
aspect of
Yep.
this. But one thing that did come up when I was talking to these current and former employees of these chains was that there is a big emphasis on the external, like, how does it look to the outside? How does it look when a parent walks in? So yeah, they do. These chains invest quite a bit in the physical plant, right? Making sure that it looks nice. And so there's an example of a creme de la creme site. I didn't, this came out in editing, but there's a Houston Chronicle article from a couple months ago, and they describe this creme de la creme childcare center as having a bubbling koi pond and like Tudor architecture, right? And like, And so if you're a parent, like, sure, like, how you're not an expert in child development. You don't necessarily know if the teacher in front of your kid, like, is being treated well, if they're being paid a good wage. How do you know if the place looks nice? And again, in most places, like, the kid is getting a decent experience. So I think it's a lot of that playing on the, we call it information asymmetry, is the political or economic term, right? Like, one group has more information than the other. And parents have a lot hard time. And this is the case actually in K-12 education and higher education too. It's very difficult to assess what's going on if you're not like an education expert, which you expect parents to have to be. So yeah, I think there is, those investments are happening, but it's you're right about threading the needle, because at the same time that these chains are investing in bubbling koi ponds, they're not paying their educators particularly more than a nonprofit or independent. In fact, the turnover, the chain, the churn is incredibly high in these programs. I cite one teacher, one parent I talked to in Richmond, Virginia, who said, like, her teacher of her kid pulled her aside one day and said, look, I'm paraphrasing next, I don't have it in front of me, but basically, look, I love your kid, I really want, but I can't be here anymore because they treat us so badly, and I'm quitting. And like, I think that, you know, unless an educator is actually pulling a parent aside and being like, look, there's a problem here, you know, it's challenging.
I'm just going to read again. I mean, remember, we're talking about private equity and its investment and its takeover of significant portions of the childcare and what they refer to as more as the childcare industry, as opposed to something that is more educational in its scope. And you write that Brendan Belew, a former special counsel for private equity at the U.S. Department of Justice, explained in his book, I got to grab him, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. And I want you to hear what he says is the sort of the model of private equity, because I want that model in the back of your head as we're listening to Elliot talk about what they're doing vis-a-vis childcare and what the consequences could be. The private equity business model rests on three pillars to return high profits to investors: buying businesses for the short term, typically 3 to 7 years, loading the companies with debt while drawing out fees, and protecting the private equity firm from legal consequences of any negative outcomes. Many private equity firms also have a history of getting involved in politics to protect their investments. Well, that's an understatement. The idea of getting involved in politics, because I think what was so interesting as I was reading this, and I was horrified by what I was reading, I was also frustrated. Because the government is beginning to recognize, Elliot, that the need for childcare is essential. That if we are going to have incredibly low unemployment, if we're going to put up barriers to immigration, if more and more people are going to have needs for nursing home care, for childcare, for whatever, then the government needs to step in. And one of the things that you discuss is, this goes back directly to the politics piece, is that there were dollars put into a lot of the infrastructure and investment bills that were passed by the Biden administration that actually did focus on what was essential for a worker and for expanding manufacturing in this country. And that is there has to be some recognition of the need for childcare. But as soon as I say that, I start to shake like a leaf, because what that means is, are they making money available that will be able to be accessed by the struggling daycare centers I know all over the country? Or did the people make sure that the language in those programs and the dollars that were going to be assigned or the credits would really be easily accessible by the sophisticated private equity companies? Because to a large extent, they may not have only been involved in the politics of these, lines and legislation, but they also knew as soon as it passed exactly how they could sort of jump on it.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes, there's danger here that we are going to be incentivizing more and more private equity interest, because more, you know, you're right when you mentioned healthcare, autism services, prison services, right? If there's a steady flow of public money, private equity wants it, right? Like, this is, they've shown their hand here. And so there is a concern that if you don't put in guardrails, and we can maybe talk about this, I think we're going to have a part two about how you do that in a policy standpoint. If you don't put in guardrails, you are going to see private equity law probably expand their footprint and actually start to go into other parts of the market, not just the most affluent, because they want to start capturing that public money. And they've said this. You know, you can look. Bright Horizons is publicly traded, which means they have to submit SEC documents.
All right, so Elliot, I got to let you go. We're gonna get you back. Maybe even tomorrow we're gonna get you back, because this is like
great.
I want everyone to understand this and the idea of, you know, these companies now in what actually on this U.S. stock market. We did an interview with Sweden when Sweden decided to start allowing vouchers and began to privatize public education in Sweden, and they talked about how many of these schools now are on the Swedish stock market. So I'm just telling you, there's a cause and effect here. Again, the article by Elliot Haspel, which is absolutely phenomenal. The end user is a dollar sign. It is not a child. How private equity and shareholders are reshaping American childcare. It is written by Elliot Haspel. It is in Early Learning Nation, the independent magazine devoted to early learning. Thank you so much for doing this, and we're grabbing you for part two, I promise. You're welcome. This, everyone, is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. Yesterday, Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, came to Columbia University and lectured students about anti-Semitism. Mike Johnson is part of a political party that has embraced anti-Semitism. They also are generally pretty hawkish on Israel, but these two things are not necessarily contradictory. The leader of Mike Johnson's party, Donald Trump, has brought people into his administration, Sebastian Gorka, Steve Bannon, and others, who are deeply anti-Semitic. He has engaged in anti-Semitic imagery and tropes in his political campaigns, and he has repeatedly suggested the Jews have dual loyalties. I have not heard a word criticizing this from Mike Johnson, Elsie Stefanik, or any other right-wing grandstander who suddenly cares about anti-Semitism. It is also true that there is anti-Semitism on the left, and I've heard too many people say that the movement isn't anti-Semitic, as if those people on Columbia's campus suggesting that Hamas killed Jewish students somehow didn't say that, as if people chanting that they want more October 7th or that they want Tel Aviv burnt to the ground, or simply suggesting that Jewish Americans are responsible for the actions of the state of Israel. These are all anti-Semitic things. Anti-Semitism is a long-standing problem. It's even older than American party politics. And the truth is, there are problems of anti-Semitism on the left and on the right. And unless you are willing to speak out and do something about both, then you are part of the problem. And Mike Johnson, if you care about any students at all at Columbia, but particularly Jewish students and Jewish faculty for that matter, do us a favor. Keep your pie hole shut and stay off of our campus. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. This is our monthly race class with Jonathan Feingold. We're up to episode, I believe, 28, and I want to remind everyone that race class is taught with Jonathan Feingold. He's a teacher at Boston University Law School, and that we started doing this because we were concerned about legislation restricting the teaching of race and racism in public schools and government entities. It is spread across the country. We are therefore conducting once a month course conversation where listeners can hear what it's like to approach race and racism from a place of curiosity and history rather than fear and anxiety. So let me welcome Jonathan back to the program for episode 28. And you entitled this Identity Politics and Playing Jewish Cards. And people are saying, wait a minute, Jonathan, this is race class. What's this Jewish card? So please do me a favor, connect the dots to why this is in fact relevant and appropriate for this class.
It's all relevant. Let me say, Arnie, it's really nice to be here with you. Yesterday, I had my final critical race theory class of the semester, and it was really wonderful to collectively with the students reflect on the past few months and everything that we've done, everything that they have done. And it's all connected. This thing that we do called race class is our little attempt to try to both model conversations, but then offer tools that we're all better equipped to think through a whole number of things that are one way or another connected with this deeply complex phenomenon called race or racism. And so it's all connected. And so, the title Identity Politics and Playing Jewish Cards, it's a play on this notion of race, the race card and identity politics, both terms that historically have been co-opted in ways to pejoratively, I think, to delegitimize and discredit racial justice efforts and claims that racism is real. We're in this incredibly grotesque moment where it's like all of higher education has lost its mind, at least university presidents. A few months ago, we were reflecting on a very different sort of display at a same house committee that held a hearing with other university presidents involving spacious claims of anti-Semitism. And we saw a redux of that this past Wednesday, where the president of Columbia did not replicate what the presidents of Harvard and Penn had done, but threw academics under the bus, seemed to just parrot back mischaracterizations. And what was, I think, deeply disturbing to increasing numbers of academics around the country. And then we saw the devastating overreaction, criminalization, calling in NYPD on college students, increasing calls for the National Guard to be deployed. And so for me, there's this moment where I feel like there's very little leadership out there in the media, in Congress, in the White House, who are offering any air support to just help people understand what's happening, see what's happening. And so the thing that I want to talk about today, just descriptively, just to describe some things, not to place moral judgment anywhere, but just to describe how Jewish identity is being mobilized by everyone, pretty much everyone, right now in order to engage in ideological combat.
Yes.
And so you ask, well, what's this have to do with critical race theory? We're theorizing race right now. We're theorizing how a social identity is being mobilized, activated in a particular moment in ways that almost everyone is engaged in, but it's often beneficial, helpful to have a vocabulary, a rubric, a taxonomy, just some categories so we can see and name what's happening. And then we're just better positioned to understand, respond in productive, responsible ways. I want to treat right now as class. So I have some thoughts. I've, I think, identified seven different, I guess yep. eight. I'm looking at the Google yep. Doc. Eight different ways in which Jewish identity is being mobilized right now for very different ends. I just want to walk through those eight, we can call them moves, get your reaction. Because when you're thinking about categories analytically, it's really important that categories are doing at least two things. One, there's a clear distinction between what's in and what's out. So you want clear boundaries. And you don't want overlap between two different categories. Just for analytical precision, categories are most helpful. You got clear boundaries around them, and they're not overlapping. We don't want Venn diagrams, because then analytically it's just not confusing. Or it is confusing. It's not all that clear. And let me just offer a little backdrop, sort of setting this stage, and then ideally we have an hour for this conversation. I think we've got 18 more minutes. Let me set up some of the background. A, first point, just to get it out of the way, identity matters. Not necessarily the same way all the time, everywhere. The way in which identity matters, in this case, we're talking about Jewish identity, how it matters is contingent on the context, on the moment. That's the first point. Second point, our individual identities, as we are seeing in this moment, especially for anyone who identifies as Jewish, is inseparable from group membership. One sense of self at an individual level is tethered to the groups, the social identities that we view ourselves as being a part of. The third is that Jews, and really, I mean Ashkenazi Jews, or Jews who would be racialized, racially understood, at least in the American context, as white, have often in the United States occupied this liminal racial status, liminal, sort of in between a couple places. One, or on the one hand, anti-Semitism is always real. It's always out there. The way in which it's manifesting differs. And so that's precarity that Jews face. But if you're Jewish, racially in the American context, white, that means you enjoy many of the benefits and privileges that attach to whiteness. There's a similarity to South and East Asians. Not racialized as white, but still enjoy a proximity to whiteness and in particular domains. It's almost an insider and outsider status at the same time. But where you are, you know, in what context matters. And then, and this last point's also important. The power of one's identity, the efficacy of foregrounding one, like a particular identity in a particular moment, comes from these common sense notions we have regarding who has the authority to speak on a particular issue. And so someone is Jewish, foregrounding that aspect of their identity is going to often do more work when the thing we're talking about is about Jewish stuff, as opposed to something else. And we should have a long conversation about why we might actually be anxious about overvaluing identity as a proxy, or over sort of understanding it as a proxy for authenticity or authority. Olufemi Taiwo, who's a philosopher at Princeton, has written a lot about this. Maybe one day we can bring him on, but we don't have time for that, because I want to get to the moves. And I want to hear your reactions. And I'm going to split the moves into sort of two broad categories. One, people who identify as Jewish, foregrounding that Jewish identity for particular reasons. And then people who are not necessary, who do not identify as Jewish, but mobilizing Jewish identity. And so we'll start with individuals who identify as Jewish, mobilizing, foregrounding their Jewish identity for different purposes. And I have essentially three in both categories. I guess four in the former category, and then four in the latter. So, and I've got a name for all of these, each of these. And the names are important. And so you should let me know if the name doesn't really work.
Hit me.
First move.
Yep.
This is what I'm going to refer to as the comrade. And I'm a law professor. So a lot of my examples, at least, will have to do with sort of university life. Imagine you are a Jewish member of a faculty, and you are concerned that the campus environment, for whatever reason right now, is one in which Jewish students, your students who you care deeply about, rightly so, are more likely than normal to face hostility on campus because of their Jewishness. That might lead you to more intentionally and actively signal your membership within the group, whether it's by putting a mezuzah up on your door, whether it's by wearing a Star of David around your neck or wearing a kippah. And the reason you're doing it is to try to create a more inviting, a warmer campus environment for others in your group. So it's the comrade.
Mm-hmm.
And you could think of variations on it for folks who aren't in the group, but want to nonetheless signal solidarity or support. And so in other contexts, it would be something like putting up a Black Lives Matter sign, right, or a pride flag in one's, right, office or one's room.
What you're almost conveying is that this is a safe space for you. So it's kind of like you're connecting them to this idea that this is a safe space. I, however, am not Jewish, but I would love to have my Jewish friends know that this is a safe space for them, but it's also a safe space for Palestinians. So I don't know what box I fit into. It's a safe space to have a conversation is what I'm trying to say. And yet what you're telling me is, again, this identity, and you're saying now you're sharing this identity in order to tell your students, at least if nothing else, understand, I know who you are, I know who I am, and there is a connection to us, i.e. the comrade.
There's lots of ways in which we can spin all this out, but it's someone who's has concerns about how students might subjectively experience the campus and want to insulate their students from sort of negative experiences by foregrounding the fact that I am part of this group. And so you can proudly also be part of this group. That's the comrade. Very different. A mobilization of Jewish identity is the next one I'm moving to, which I refer to as the sword. And this is individuals or entities that are foregrounding Jewish identity to assert an authoritative perspective, to claim an authoritative perspective, and to discredit competing viewpoints, both from within and without the Jewish community. And so I see what the ADL, American Defamation League, Anti-Defamation League, excuse me, has been doing is sort of using Jewish identity as a sword.
Yes.
To delegitimize broadly criticism of Israel and Israeli policy. And part of that is a fight over who is an authentic and authoritative Jewish voice. Because a lot of the what I view as attacks, rhetorical attacks from ADL, have been directed at what you would generally think of as sort of left-wing or more progressive Jews. And mm-hmm. So I would just, as one example, from in October, this past October, on the 18th, there was a protest of Jewish rabbis calling for ceasefire.
Right.
And an ADL director of their DC office referred to these rabbis as far-left radicals who do not represent the majority of the Jewish community. And again, part of what we're doing is just describing different ways in which identity is mobilized in a moment for various ends. And so, no, jump in, go ahead.
So is the ADL sort of creating this hierarchy of Jewishness? So that if you don't fit into their hierarchy, then you are a lesser Jew, and therefore they're defining you. You are the better Jew. You are the more authentic Jew. You are the lesser Jew. And you know the reason I bring this up? I used to live in Minnesota. I adored Paul Wellstone. Paul Wellstone was Jewish. Paul Wellstone ran against a fellow Jew, Rudy Boschwitz. Do you know what Rudy Boschwitz said about Paul Wellstone? He wasn't a good Jew because he married a shiksa. He married a non-Jew. So it created the idea of hierarchy. I am your better Jew. He is your lesser Jew, which turned out in Minnesota to offend a lot of Jews. And in part, Paul Wellstone got that support. But again, this is on a much more micro kind of scale, not as toxic as the one we're seeing with the ADL. But it is not uncommon for people to sort of establish this hierarchy. I'm a better Christian. I'm a better Jew. And now with what's going on, the ADL is basically sort of marginalizing and using this as, in this case, as an incredible sword. because they really are setting up this pecking order. And some people have a right to speak. And in some ways, what the ADL says is you don't have a right to speak.
Well, and here's how I'll respond. So it's important to remember that a lot of what is being contested right now is what is and what is not anti-Semitism. And so the ADL, they're very clear in this tweet that I just referenced, yeah. They say explicitly, this person says, let's be very clear, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And then if we connect that to the, again, this common sense logic that we many of us have, that the individuals or entities that are part of the group that are the target of the harm have greater authority to speak to whether, like, what is, or I guess just to put it very plainly, there's a common sense logic that if you are Jewish, you have more authority to identify what is and what is not anti-Semitism. Right. And so part of the fight is over who can claim an authentic Jewish voice or perspective, or an authoritative Jewish voice or perspective. And I am not right now saying that anyone has that. To the contrary, the critical race theorist observation would be that individuals who identify as Jewish are incredibly diverse, heterogeneous in all sorts of different ways, and have different conceptions of what anti-Semitism is. And in moments of deep political conflict, there will often be efforts to discredit competing viewpoints for, through different means. Now, I want to sort of flip to a different move that is sort of the, one can think of it as the opposite of the sword, which is the shield. And this is someone who is foregrounding identity. In this case, we're talking about Jewish identity in order to defend against the claims that a particular perspective is illegitimate. And so you can think of progressive Jewish organizations like If Not Now, that have been repeatedly calling for ceasefire and have been foregrounding their Jewishness and their Jewish identity through rhetoric such as not in our name. I'm not suggesting that it is not earnest. I think it likely is all earnest, but it is also likely aware, cognizant that there is greater sort of public credibility cachet to say not in our name than to be an outsider and saying not in their name, in part because it is pushing back against an entity like the ADL's attempt to define a contested claim or to have the authority to do so. Or you've got this Columbia PhD student, Jonathan Ben Menachem, who just wrote an op-ed in which he is in part foregrounding not just his Jewish identity, but the Jewish identity of many Jewish students on campus who, among other things, were having a Seder this week to celebrate Passover on the grounds of Columbia in solidarity with Jews and non-Jews, Palestinians, and others who are protesting, among other things, Israel's ongoing military assault on Gaza and other occupied territories, in which, like, the news feed remains horrific on what is actually happening there. But this is, and right now, especially since October 7th, my instinct is that many Jewish Americans who are very concerned current Israeli policy and practices have been foregrounding their Jewish identity in a way they might not with other issues because of the way in which Israel is conceptually tethered, is practically tethered to Jewishness. It's a moment in which the claim is a claim as an insider, as about one's own family, then as an outsider, which we tend to understand differently. And so it's a shield. It's foregrounding identity to defend the legitimacy of one's claim, as opposed to a sword foregrounding identity to assert a singular authoritative position and to delegitimize another's claim.
Can you refresh my recollection? Is part of the issue as well is that every Jew in the world, if they come to Israel, automatically becomes a citizen of Israel. I'm half Italian, but if I go to Italy, I'm not a citizen of Italy. I'm half Norwegian. If I go to Norway, I'm not. There's a gatekeeping function. But given the nature of the Jewish state, given the nature of the formation of the Jewish state, given this idea that this is the sort of safe place for all Jews, is part of the issue too that every Jew in the world is perceived to have two allegiances, that they are perceived to be an American or Brit or French, but they also, as soon as they return or come to Israel, there's this idea that they have another status. Does that also complicate the situation? Am I accurate in my understanding? I just need to ask, because there's a piece of me that's still trying to figure out, how do you separate? And yet at the same time, you talked about overlapping of identity, but to a large extent, almost by definition, Israel by definition overlaps identity.
Yes, Israel by definition overlaps identity in different sorts of ways. But again, our modest goal right now is just to identify different ways in which identity gets mobilized. And in this moment, Jewish identity is being mobilized in order to essentially spar over competing ideological positions or viewpoints.
Yeah.
And invites much longer conversations about the way in which identity is mobilized in different contexts and who has the ability at what time to speak with an authoritative voice. And then the sorts of claims that you see get thrown at, for example, progressive Jews, the question is, well, like, are they really all that Jewish?
Exactly.
And it's
exactly.
So we only have a couple of minutes, so I just want to get to a different move. And this is from someone who is not Jewish. This is who I'm referring to as the cynic. That might be too generous. And this is someone or an entity that instrumentally, opportunistically weaponizes rhetorical claims about concerns about anti-Semitism to further political agendas that at their core have no interest, are unconcerned in the safety or well-being of Jewish Americans. And the House Committee stuff, Virginia Fox, Elise Stefanik, the nakedly cynical turn to anti-Semitism in that space is one thing. But I saw today that Mike Johnson, the House Majority Leader, is going to visit Columbia in order to meet, quote unquote, meet with Jewish students regarding concerns about anti-Semitism. It is hard in the Rolodex of American politicians to find someone who is less concerned with actual, like, meaningful precarities and vulnerabilities that Jewish Americans face on a daily basis than Mike Johnson. And he is sending out press releases about how he's making his pilgrimage to Columbia.
And again, he has his cover because of what he just recently did with the money being spent now in defense of Ukraine, in defense of Israel, in defense of Asian countries. So again, in some ways, he's saying, see, look what I've done. And now whether you trust him or not, he can sort of use that as his bridge to then have the legitimacy to go to Colombia. On that note, so guess what, Mr. Feingold? You're coming back, but not in a month. You're coming back sooner than that because we have to talk about this. Because it is so fractious, everything is so difficult, and it's difficult to have a conversation, and you've been able to conduct a conversation, and we need to continue this. So I'm going to invite you back, and I'm not going to wait a month, so be prepared.
Well, if I come back, it's going to be with not just me, because it's important to note that one of the goals of the sorts of really McCarthyist committee hearings that we're seeing is to blacklist academics.
Yes. And you will come with you will come with other players. Episode 28, Identity Politics and Playing the Jewish Card. We've been talking with Professor Jonathan Feingold from Boston University Law School. This is Arnie Arneson. It is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think that you might go let yourself be free. Let's go back, let's go way on the way back when. I didn't even know you couldn't have been too much more than 10.